Okay, so we are continuing with prayer, and every time I think it's the last the last installation, but it doesn't turn out that way, but I'm pretty sure this time I'm right. At any rate, the thing we discussed last time was the intermediary, and that was several weeks ago, if you remember, and I mentioned at that time that a person should pray to God directly, and this is the way that the Torah prescribes and the way of the prophets. And as a matter of fact, I was discussing today with David chapter 19 of Isaiah, and I believe some of you may have studied it together with David, and over there it states clearly that when Egypt called to God, God answered them because they had reached the proper idea concerning God, and they left their idolatrous practices, and therefore God answered them directly. So man need only to pray to God himself and not seek any intermediary. As a matter of fact, the seeking of an intermediary is an idolatrous concept, as you know. And the person that does that forfeits the entire benefit of praying to God, the whole the benefit of realization of God's existence, the ordering of his priorities, and even changing his life, which is in his hands. Just like a person can change his life by going out and in the real world, or let us say, if we take an example from the financial world, by acting properly and acting intelligently, or with regard to any matter in his life, so too a person can actually change his life by being creative in presenting God with an alternative plan for his existence, and that way God can accept it. It is possible that God should accept that plan, and because of that he could save his life. As I mentioned, Moses, if it wasn't for Moses thinking and his creativity and his planning in his prayer, then the people of Israel would have been destroyed, as is clearly stated in the Bible. Now, I told you, I said nowhere, Maimonides does not say that one should ask an intermediary to pray, nor does the Shulchan Aruch say that a person should ask an intermediary to pray. But I must admit that I didn't really convey to you at the time the whole truth concerning this matter, and I'll explain to you why. The reason I didn't is because, as I said before, the Torah, just like the Torah is against idolatry, the Torah recognizes that idolatry is something which is very close to the human heart, very tempting for people. And that's when the Torah says you shouldn't turn after your heart, then the rabbis, the scholars say that is referring to what the scholars call minus. It means the denial of God's existence, which is the same thing as idolatry. By the way, and according to the Torah's philosophy, atheism and idolatry are just two sides of one coin. They're not different phenomena. And if we have time, I'll explain that to you. I'll explain to you later why that is exactly. But the Torah is very concerned because the Torah always considers idolatry to be something which is very close to a person's heart. And that's why Moses, in the end of his life, when he warned the people of Israel, in his almost his last words, he warned against a person whose heart turns away from God and who is attracted to and practices idolatry. And that's because that was the major, his main concern was that that if there is anyone such as that, then the people are obligated to root him out and to deal with him according to halacha. Now, the idea that a person should seek an intermediary is idolatrous because the idolater is always looking for that magical power and force, and he believes that many times that the person that prays for him is endowed with some kind of a supernatural power, a holy man, you see. And ascribing that kind of power to a human being, no matter who he is really an idolatrous concept. And the only one that we ascribe any kind of real powers to is God himself. And people, however, find that very difficult. They always are looking for something physical or something human that they wish to raise, to endow with some kind of powers, and that is the part of the idolatrous trend of man. So looking for someone to pray to God for you and to somehow magically bring about your salvation is idolatrous in concept, not just an action and concept. It's an idolatrous, that's the draw of idolatry, that magical power, that magical individual that's going to save my life. That's an idolatrous idea. The only thing that will save a person's life, according to Torah, is if he listens to God's laws and lives according to them and studies his Torah and is just. Anything other than that cannot save him. There are no other forces. That's why we don't seek intermediaries. It's wrong. Besides the fact that it would be a forfeiture, as I said before, of all the benefits of prayer. So, getting back to what I did hide something from you at that time, and I will tell you what it is. I said the Shulchan Aruch does not say that one should ask anybody to pray for him, but there is the Shulchan Aruch is really he is the called the Beis Yosef and Rabbi Joseph Cairo. He's the author of Shulchan Aruch, and it is true, he doesn't say anything of the like. Maimonides also does not mention anywhere that a person should ask someone, some righteous individual, to pray for him either. But there is a commentary on the Shulchan Aruch known as the Ramah. And the Ramah is, he adds to the Shulchan Aruch throughout the Shulchan Aruch, he adds certain additional commentaries where he feels that the author of the Shulchan Aruch was left out, omitted something. So sometimes it's an argument between him and the author of the Shulchan Aruch. Sometimes it's not. He's merely speaking for the. You see, the Rabbi Joseph Cairo was a Sephardic, and the Sephardic have their own customs, and the Ramah, he was an Ashkenazic. So he really wrote in order to place right on the text, to add to the text the Ashkenazic customs as well. But he also does add and sometimes even argues with the author of the Shulchan Aruch. Now he says he has, in the laws concerning visiting the sick, not in the laws of prayer, mind you, but in laws concerning visiting the sick, he says there are some that say that if a person, if it has someone in his family that is ill, that he should go to a wise person in the city, and he should ask that person to pray for him. Okay, now I didn't mention that to you last time because I wanted to make clear the ideas concerning prayer, and I didn't want you to distort them, and that we have done. But nevertheless, I wish to also convey to you this statement of the Ramah, as I said, the addition to the code of law known as the Shulchan Aruch, where he does mention this. He says, some say that, again, if someone is sick in your family, that you should go to a wise person and ask him to pray for that individual. Okay, now this would seem to be contrary to what I said. But I want you to understand, first of all, the perspective of this statement, that it is certainly not the way. Even, first of all, as I mentioned before, the author of the Shulchan Aruch does not mention it at all. Maimonides doesn't mention it at all. These are two major halachists. So from their standpoint, there is no such there is no such procedure. So that I want to be clear to you. And even the Ramah mentions it. He says it with the introductory words of some say, which means that some maintain that way and others disagree. And even in the framework that he puts it, it's pretty obvious that that is not a major thing. It's more like an optional kind of thing, good advice to do it, but not major. Major is the person supposed to pray himself. Nevertheless, he does say that there are those that say that one should do that procedure, should go to the wise person, and should ask him to pray for him. So I wanted to mention, in all honesty, that there is such a statement by one of our scholars. Where is it based on? As you know, everything Shulchan Aruch is based on the Talmud. There is a Talmudic statement to that effect in the tractate of Baba Basra, and it's on page 116. And I'll quote it to you. The statement is as follows: that let me just get it. yes, it says like this. The Gemara says, the Talmud says that Rabbi Pinchas, the son of Chama, commented, any person, a person who has a sick individual, sick person in his household, he should go to a Chacham, a wise person, and the wise person should ask ask God for mercy. Okay, and he says, he quotes a where does his source? His source is from Mishlei. That's Proverbs 16. Okay, now let me just show you where it is. Proverbs 16. Proverbs 16:14 states like this: the anger of a king is like angels of death, and a wise person will wipe it away. I don't know what your translation is. I don't have an English translation here, but it should be something pretty close to that. That's Proverbs 16:14 again. So now we have to understand, in order to comprehend the statement of the of Rabbi Pinchas, the son of Chama, you have to, of course, go back to the source. And the source, again, is Proverbs. You have to understand the source. Of course, I would like to explain it. It's obvious that, you see, this is not considered, according to Maimonides and according to the Rabbi Joseph Cairo, this statement of the Talmud is not considered a halachic statement. And that's an extremely important thing. One has to be a great scholar in order to be able to distinguish between what is a halachic statement of the Talmud and what is not a halachic statement. Now, the two types of statements are treated in a totally different way. The halachic statement has a certain form. It's a mandatory, it's obligatory. It follows a certain structure and pattern. And a scholar who knows halacha will knows exactly what that pattern is. On the other hand, statements that are non-halachic have their own... They operate in their own orbit, so to speak. They're different, of a different nature, and they have to be dealt with in a different manner. That's the agadic statements. So these, the agadic and the halachic, are really like two different worlds, and how you approach them. There are two different methods of approaching them. Unfortunately, and when you have the Talmud, it doesn't make a state in front of each statement. This is a halachic statement, or this is an agadic statement. It does not say that. So most of the time, scholars agree on what is halachic and what is not. Over here, apparently, there is an argument that Maimonides and Rabbi Joseph Cairo felt that this was not a halachic statement. That's why they didn't bring it into their code of law, because it is a philosophic type statement. And a philosophic statement has to be understood in a different framework. On the other hand, as the Rambam mentions, he says some people say that you should do it. That's why he says some people say that you should do it. You should go to the Chacham, because they took the statement as being halachic. Now, I would just like to explain, the side that says that it's an agadic statement, I don't have to explain, because it's a philosophical concept, and it really isn't something which is practical. So whatever that philosophical concept is, it's nice to understand, but it's for our purposes at this point, it doesn't really make any difference. But if it's a halachic statement, then it does make a difference, because then the halacha is saying that you should, or is at least, it is not mandatory, it appears, but at least it's halachically, it's considered a valid action. It's advisable, in other words, halachically. Now, the way I would approach this is to try to analyze the source. The source is from Proverbs 16:14, as I said. Now, Proverbs 16:14 is not speaking about this. When you take a look at Proverbs, it says, the anger of the king is like messengers of death, and the wise man can remove it, wipe it away. Okay. Now, what does Proverbs mean? Proverbs means that it means he's speaking about a king, and he's saying that you know, many people are foolish. They will see a king is angry, but they're not upset because nothing happened yet. The king didn't do anything. So people are afraid of a king's decree, but if a king gets angry, they feel, well, look, nothing happened. So King Solomon, the wise king, says that those people are making a serious error, because the anger of a king is different. The anger of a king, if he is angry, he lays in wait. And it's like messengers of death. Sooner or later, this person is going to be destroyed by the king. So the king is not like an ordinary person, and his anger is not to be taken lightly. It's like a constant burning fire, and sooner or later, he will destroy his victim. So he says that the anger of a king is a dangerous thing. And then he says, but the wise man will remove it. Which means to say, obviously, that a wise person who knows how to deal diplomatically with the king can remove the anger of the king. And he will make sure that he does so. He won't let the king go to sleep, so to speak, before this anger is removed, because he knows, and he's wise, and he knows that the anger of the king is a dangerous thing, just waiting for the messengers of death to be sent. So, therefore, the King Solomon says that a wise man knows how to diffuse that anger, that dangerous anger of the king. Now, what that has to do with our Talmudic statement is as follows, that the Talmud simply says that when it's speaking about the king, that there is a human king, and then there is the real king, which is God. And he applies the same concept to God. In other words, he's saying the same principle is applicable in relationship to the ultimate king, who is God the Creator. Now, of course, it's hard to understand at first sight as how you can make that comparison. Because if a king is angry at my friend, and I'm a wise man, and I know how to assuage and to diffuse the anger of the king, that's because I will use my political, diplomatic acumen to placate him. That's something you can do with a human king. But in relationship to God, it doesn't seem possible, because God knows all, and you can't be diplomatic with God. The wise man can't be diplomatic with God. That's nonsensical in relationship to the Creator. Okay. So we have to understand how the Talmud could make that analogy to go from the human king to God. In my opinion, it's as follows, that how does the wise man appease the king? How does he, more than appease him actually, it means he removes the anger completely. When a king is angry at somebody, it's on a personal level. Something upset him. So there's a personal animosity, and that's what King Solomon says is very dangerous, to allow that animosity to exist. Okay? Now, the way the wise person diffuses the anger is that when he speaks to the king, he speaks to him on an objective plane and removes the king from his personal feelings toward this individual, and places him on a grand scale of king who runs his entire country, and places him on an objective plane and makes him realize that this individual is just a part, a component of his entire kingdom, and he's not really to be taken seriously, and the great emotional hatred that he has towards this person is because he's overestimating, he's getting lost in the world of the personal. But on an objective plane, there is nothing to be angry about. And that's really the most basic method that the wise man would use to remove the king's anger. In other words, the wise man, what is wisdom? Wisdom always is objective. The personal isn't wise. The personal is always the emotional. When people fight with each other or argue with each other and get into feuds, it's always because they can't rise above the petty and the personal. A wise man, when he enters the scene, he says, what are you arguing about? This is nonsensical. There's nothing really important here. And if a person would have perspective, he actually would never really find any reason to argue with anybody, because it's all nonsensical. It doesn't, in terms of the framework, the greater framework of reality, none of these things are really important. 100 years from now, none of these things are going to matter. So if a person has a great framework of wisdom and knowledge, the petty things don't, he's not obsessed with the petty. A person who's not in the greater framework is always obsessed with the small world. He's irritated by somebody says something against him, it irritates him, because he's in the petty world, the small world. The wise man is in the objective world. That's what it means when it says the wise man removes the anger of the king. How does he remove the anger of the king? It doesn't mean he tells the king, well, he didn't mean it. This, you know, people don't usually believe these kind of excuses. Some people try to be peacemakers by saying, well, he said that, but he didn't mean it. It may work a little bit temporarily, but truthfully, people don't really don't. People usually know better. They say, no, he did mean it. He said it and he meant it. And the reason why they may give in is because they don't want to look bad themselves. But down deep, they always keep that anger. The real way to remove anger, and this is what Solomon is saying, is to get the person onto the objective plane. Once the person's on the objective plane, then they realize that it's nonsensical. I got caught up. A king could be running an entire government, and he could be obsessed with one little person. And then when he realizes this, he removes himself. He removes all his psychic energy from this individual, and he places it where it's supposed to be in terms of his entire kingdom, you see. Then it seems silly to be angry at this little this individual that's almost worthless, you see. So, in other words, what King Solomon is saying is that the wise man diffuses the king's anger by encouraging him and taking him on a trip away from his petty emotion to the world, to the objective world. Now, what does this have to do with God? With God, again, you can't say such a thing. God is the perfect being, and there's no way that a person can ever say that God is deficient, or that God is emotional, or that God is petty. That would indicate he doesn't have the proper idea of God. But what it means is like this. What it means is that an individual lives really on two planes. He lives as an individual, and he also lives as a member of the society within which he functions. And God judges an individual on both of those bases. In other words, he judges an individual in terms of his own personal worth, and he judges an individual also in terms of his worth and in terms of the entire society. He is a component of his society. And that's why Rabbi Soloveitchik always used to say that when a person prays, he should always think of himself as a component of the society. Because the fact is that God many times permits a person to exist because of the fact that he benefits the society, not necessarily because he himself is worthy. Okay? So a person is judged in two frameworks, his own personal framework, and then insofar as he is an important and useful element of the society. Now, that's why now you see the parable. The parable is from the human king, but the analogy is to God. It's similar, but not the same. By the human king, the way that his anger is diffused is by taking him away from the individual and putting him in the framework of the whole. When the king realizes that he has an entire kingdom, he shouldn't be obsessed with what this little person said to him, shouldn't bother him, so then he's functioning in terms of the entire kingdom. Now God, when God spares someone, he does so based either upon his own worth, his own self-worth, or upon his value as a member of the society in which he lives. Now that's what the Talmudic statement means. Talmudic statement is, in other words, when the Talmudic statement is that the person it compares God's anger to the anger of a human being, so to speak. It's like a parable, which means that if somebody's ill, you'd say that God is angry at him. Of course, it doesn't mean that God has a temper or God is angry, but it's the Talmud says the Torah speaks in the language of man. It conveys, we have to use some kind of a parable to give us the idea that God is relating to him in a way that he is making him ill. So we say, that's why the Torah says God got angry. It doesn't really mean that he has anger, of course. Now, what's happening here is as follows, that the person can pray for himself, and that's the most essential prayer. He has to pray for himself insofar as his own personal self-worth is concerned. So there he has to pray to God, he has to repent, and he has to change his life. And that's really where his essential salvation is. And that's where he changes, and that's where God, if he judged him before that he should die, if he changes, then perhaps, and if it, then perhaps his judgment will be changed as well. But what the Talmud is saying is that there's another perspective, and that is the individual's value, his worth, insofar as the society is concerned. Now, who knows what that worth is? And the answer is the wise man, the man who is the leader of the society, of the town, of the city, of the society. So that's why the Talmud says that a person who has someone in his household who is ill, he should go to the wise man. Because the wise man can pray to God in a different framework. He is the leader of the people, and he knows the value of the people. So he could pray to God insofar as this individual's self-worth is as a member of the community from that standpoint. Because he really has the knowledge in that area. So that's why what the Talmud is saying is, not that the scholar, by the way, it doesn't say go to a tzaddik, it doesn't say go to a righteous man, it says go to the wise man, the intelligent man, because the Torah, the intelligent man, the man of knowledge, is really the center of the whole Torah system, and he is the leader. So it says go to the wise man, because the wise man, who is the wise leader and knows the people of the city, then after the person has exhausted all his own personal prayer, then in addition he should go to the leader of the city and have him pray to God that this individual is necessary, or so far as the community is concerned, and that God should spare him because of the community. That is an additional kind of prayer that only the leader, the scholar, of the leader of the community can make to God, because he's the only one that has the real knowledge and perspective insofar as that is concerned, because that's part of being a leader. So the scholar over here is not an intermediary. That's the point I wanted to make. It's not an intermediary. It means there's a different aspect of prayer that can only be done properly by the person who is the rabbi, the leader, the scholar. Because that person can pray to God from a different framework completely, the framework of an individual insofar as he's a component of the community. And that's what the Talmud means. So it does not mean, and this, I want to make this quite clear, it does not mean that this great man is a magical force of power that's going to save his life, because then there will be no need to pray for himself. Not only that, the first priority would be to go to the scholar right away. And this, as I said, is even in the Talmudic statement, it doesn't say that this is this is his first priority. It says it's a good idea, it's advisable that he does so, even if you take this statement halachically. If you don't take it halachically, of course, then it has another meaning. It's not really something which comes under the realm of halacha. It has a philosophical meaning. But even if you take it as a halachic statement, as the Rambam does, it is not the first priority, and the reason is because he is not functioning as an intermediary. A person is supposed to pray to God himself directly, but it is stating that it is advisable to go to the leader of the congregation, and he should pray to God from his own aspect, because he has a different perspective from which he can approach God, which the individual himself really cannot do, because he doesn't have the average person doesn't have a proper evaluation of himself.
Okay, remember in Proverbs chapter 19, now we've been talking about prayer,
yes,
and the technical...
19, okay,
all right, Proverbs 19, we've been talking...
What?
Verse 1.
Okay.
It says, better is the poor that walketh in his integrity than he that is perverse in his lips and is a fool.
Right.
Now, see, some people do not have all the knowledge and all the access to everything that you have and even we have here.
Right.
So you've got this guy here that's praying.
Right.
And he's praying to God the best he knows how.
Right.
Again, talking of Solomon, he's walking in his integrity.
Right, but take a look at verse 2 and 9.
Yeah, I know that. I want to get this one.
Okay.
He's poor and he's walking in his integrity, then he that is perverse in his lips and is a fool. Now, alas, that the soul be without knowledge, it is not good. Now, it doesn't say that it's worthless. And he that hasteneth with his feet sinneth. Now, the foolishness of man perverteth his ways, and his heart fretteth against the Lord. But now, we're talking about a guy beginning in verse 1, that's walking in integrity. In other words, he's doing all that he knows to do.
Right, but he's not a fool.
But he's not a fool, no.
No, can't say he's a fool. When the person is a fool, then it's helpless. I mean, a fool basically in Torah is not acceptable. There's no such thing as a person as an individual pleading ignorance. And as a matter of fact, the Talmud states clearly that if a person violates the law unintentionally because of lack of knowledge, that's considered intentional, because he should have knowledge, and it's obligatory on every Jew to, according to Maimonides, this is clear, to have a set time for study in the daytime and at nighttime. That would mean like an hour, at least an hour in the day and an hour at night. A 12-hour period should not go by where a person has not actually set himself down to study, according to Maimonides. And this is a basic mitzvah of the Torah.
All right, Rabbi?
Yeah.
All right, well, let me make a point here.
It does not mean that a person is a poor fool.
All right, but let me make this point, that what you have to say, what you've just said, I'll buy in a Torah society. But what about the masses of people that we deal with as B'nai Noach, that have absolutely no idea of what you're talking about, and many times they don't even know what we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And these people are walking in their integrity. They're working and walking with the knowledge they have.
Well, that's not right, because the point is that the question that I have to ask is a very simple question. Are these people setting aside important blocks of time to study Torah? If they are, then they will be walking with a different integrity, the integrity that has knowledge. And if they are not, then they are culpable, because they're setting aside time to earn money, they're setting aside time for their family, they're setting aside time for their pleasures, but they are not setting aside time for the most important thing in life, and that is the study and knowledge of Torah. So my answer is that there is no excuse. As a matter of fact, I would say that is a major difference between Christianity and between the Torah philosophy. In Christianity, you have the poor, humble, ignorant fisherman, which is considered a righteous person. In Torah, the ignorant cannot be righteous. The two are mutually exclusive. Man must set aside time to gain knowledge of Torah. If he doesn't, he has no relationship with God, because his relationship with God is based upon knowledge. He can't just...
Okay, may I interrupt again?
Sure.
All right, the point that I would make here is that I talk to people regularly, and I could give you an example, and I won't take the time, about a guy that I talked to today.
Yeah.
Tom Slater sowed some seed with this guy. You know, the Burley ex-Marine sowed some seed with this guy over a year ago. I've sown some seed with him. All right, this guy is a church-going, and I'll call him a Bible-thumping Baptist. All right, this guy has done most of his life. He's thought he served God.
Right.
And he has, and again, I will use the word, the translations, he's walked in integrity. He's studied his Bible, but he studied it the way he was taught by the preachers. Now, is this guy, how do you put this guy in the context of Proverbs?
Well, I would say the same thing, you know, Maimonides mentions in the guide. He says that if a person will say that people who are ignorant can be excused because they were raised in this manner, they were taught this, and they're acting to the best of their abilities, he says, then you could say the same thing about idolaters, because idolaters were also raised in the houses of idolatry, and they had their ministers, and they were taught by their ministers, and yet we see that God does not accept that as an excuse. I would say the exact same thing as Maimonides says. I don't think any human being is of giving us any inkling of how God judges a human being, whether the individual is punished for that or not, that's only God knows. The only thing that we can say is that an individual who has false ideas concerning God cannot have a relationship with God. That is impossible. Whether God will punish him for not, whether he's culpable or not, that only God knows. Maybe he wasn't culpable. I don't know. All I could say is that so far as his relationship with God, it cannot be. If his idea of God is wrong, no matter how sincere he thinks or we think he is, the answer is he has no relationship with God. And that's the bottom line according to Torah. You want to question why? Is it fair? Is it not? I mean, now we'll be going into other philosophical questions, which perhaps we should at another time. But I think the bottom line of Torah is, without any doubt, according to every position, that if a person does not have, if a person is sincere, or we think he's sincere, he is not to be excused. If his ideas are false, then he can't relate to God. If he doesn't know how to pray, he can't pray. If he doesn't know what God is, he could have an old bearded man in the sky and pray to that image. He's not praying to God. And it's unfortunate, but that's the way it is.
Rabbi,
yes.
This is Charles McKeon.
Yes, sir.
I hope that with these questions that you don't think that I haven't learned as I should over the past weeks that we've been discussing prayer, and certainly, this may precipitate in a longer answer than we've got time this evening. But basically, the question is this: in our prayer life, which is more important? And I know some of these things we've touched a little bit. Again, I'm looking for clarity here.
Sure,
in our prayer life, which is more important, to pray frequently, whether we want to or not? And in other words, can we become repetitious and not having any meaning or purpose in our prayers? Or the second part is to pray because we need to, and totally be sincere with everything we speak. In other words, I'm speaking of which is, more important here, the frequency, or actually praying at a time that we feel that we're totally sincere with praying to God and praising Him, and even having requests for ourselves or others. And the third part of this is, where does it put us with God? When we set a time to pray regardless, and just follow that schedule only.
Well, the Talmud states, with regard to your first question, that it is better to have a small amount with quality than a large quantity without quality. Okay, so therefore I would say that prayer is a qualitative phenomenon. It's more important to have the quality there and have a smaller prayer than to have a long prayer, which really the person isn't really involved, and his mind is not thinking. He didn't think about before he started the prayer who he's standing before. He didn't think about his words of praise of God didn't really have any true meaning. The important thing is the meaning and the quality. That is what is foremost, and that's where the person obviously achieves. Again, we don't pray for God. We pray for ourselves. It's an opportunity that God gave us to raise ourselves to a higher level. So if we don't achieve that, nothing's accomplished. God doesn't need man's prayers. So the important thing, again, is the quality. That's certainly is clear according to our understanding of tefillah and according to the scholars of the Talmud. The second question, I don't remember, was that a separate question or was that part of the first question?
Charlie said you answered that good. I got one. My name's Jeff King.
Yes.
And on the Thanksgiving part of the Shemona Esrei,
yes,
could you, did you make any changes in that prayer? And I'm relating back to the first one where you changed the idea of the forefathers for us to say the patriarchs.
Right, the patriarchs, that's right. Now, in the Thanksgiving one, is there any changes? I don't think we made any changes in that one. You're referring to the blessing before the last, am I right?
Yes. And another part of my question is, if I said forefathers, I don't necessarily have to be thinking about, you know, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I mean, God is the God of everybody, and
That's not correct. You have to be. You should specifically think about Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, because the reason is because they are for two reasons. The first reason is because when you're mentioning them, you're mentioning the fact that they reached the highest level of the recognition of God. So that's important to mention that your idea of God is the same idea as theirs. In other words, we are recognizing the fact that our idea, we aren't on their level, but we subscribe to their idea of God. We are along that path, but they had it. They were far superior to us, and they had it more fully developed. So that's important to mention those specific people. That's one reason. The second reason it's important to mention those people is because you're speaking about the fact that God had a special... Because these people reached this level, God had a special relationship with them. So that's an important principle in prayer, that God relates to man as man rises to a higher level. That's the basic... That's why you're praying, actually. If God didn't relate to man, there'd be no reason to pray. So there are all the stories in the Bible about the patriarchs are there to show that God does relate to certain individuals in a grand way. And that's the purpose of those stories, how God related to Abraham, to show us, to teach us about the manner in which God does relate to individuals that reach an extremely high level. So it is important to mention the patriarchs. Okay.
So we should replace that forefathers with patriarchs, right?
Patriarchs or the fathers of Israel or, you know, right.
Okay, well, I got one more question. I don't remember where I heard it, but in the relation to using God's name in vain, I don't remember where I heard it, like I said, but praying for something that God's done... Like you see a fire truck. This is the instance I heard. I can't remember where it was, but you see a fire truck, you shouldn't pray that, you know, that's not your house.
Oh, right.
So could you say something on that? I'm not sure.
Okay. A person is not supposed to pray for something that is outside the realm of possibility, of normal realm of possibility. In other words, a person is not... If, for instance, if a person, as you said, the case that you mentioned, I mean, a person was driving home and he heard fire engines, you know, so pray to God that it's not my house. Because it's too late. Either it is his house or it's not his house. So it's a wasted prayer. In other words, prayer is not, and this is an important point, and it's the difference, again, between idolatrous prayer and between Torah prayer. Idolatrous prayer is merely wish fulfillment. It's wishing. So therefore, whatever a wish is, a prayer is. So that's why, to the average person, when I say idolatrous, I mean people who are unenlightened. I really don't mean just people who... And I certainly don't mean only primitive people. I mean anybody that doesn't have the enlightenment of Torah. So an unenlightened person, to him, prayer is wishing. So when a person drives, if he would be driving towards his home and he hears fire engines, he'd wish, I wish it's not my house. So therefore, he thinks that would be a valid prayer. But the enlightened Torah person knows that a prayer is not a wish. A prayer is an intelligently formulated request that we place before the creator of the universe. And we do not say stupid things before the creator of the universe, just like you wouldn't say a stupid thing before anyone that you respected. Therefore, either the fire engine is at your house or it's not. There's no prayer that's going to make any difference.
Rabbi.
Yes.
This is Charlie again.
Yes, Charlie.
What I wanted to ask you here is along the same line of thinking about, say, decisions that we have actually made, we're really saying there's no use in prayer if we've kind of made our decisions already. Is that correct? I mean, we should not pray about it. We should just go ahead and follow through with the decisions.
Yes, basically. The only thing you can do, you can't pray that that situations should be favorable to your decision. That you can do, because that didn't happen yet. But something that occurred already, if a person can't say, you can't pray to God, well, I hope I didn't lose $1,000 in the stock market today, because either he did or he didn't. It's too late now. That would be a wasted, foolish statement. But if you make a decision to invest money, you can pray that things should be favorable. You should have a favorable outcome. That you can't pray for. That certainly is valid. That certainly is a valid prayer, because nothing happened yet, and it's possible that it will be favorable towards you. But once something has occurred, it's impossible to go backwards.
Rabbi, yes. This is Gary Buchanan.
Yes.
My prayer relates to when you first was talking, when you opened, you talked about the personality of idolatry, and you talked about there is a loathing in mankind to yearn after the supernatural.
Right.
Isn't this, in fact, the same tactic God used on mankind with supernatural happenings? And I'm speaking of Moses and Daniel, and we could give a lot of examples.
Yes, that's correct. But I would advise you, if you can, to read the Torah from Sinai article that I wrote. And David, I think, has some copies left, because if you read it, you'll discover that Torah, the miracles of Torah, were done in order to take man away from miracles, not to have him seek miracles. The Torah gives man a way of life where man can relate to God on a daily basis without any miracles, through a higher form of higher relationship than miracles. The miracles that were done by God were done because it was necessary in order to establish the system, not for any other reason. The system, once established, does not depend on miracles, nor does it ask man to seek miracles. We do not seek miracles. As a matter of fact, the Talmud says we do not rely on miracles, and a person is supposed to live within the realm of the normal. If you look at the Bible, you'll see when God told Abraham that he is going to have a son from Sarah, he laughed, and he was surprised, and he was amazed. And he was a man who had the greatest knowledge of God, yet he did not expect any miracles, because he knew that God created the laws of nature. God loves the laws of nature. They're his laws. He does not wish to break them. And the Talmudic, the rabbis say that when it says that God, when God says, I went down to save the people of Israel from Egypt, it says he went down. It went down means it was something that was not what God wished to do, but God had to do it in order to establish the nation of Israel so that the Torah should be given to the world. But it was not, God created the laws of nature, and he doesn't like to change the laws of nature. It is only done when there is no alternative. But the system of Torah is to take a person away from the miraculous. On the contrary, they should see God through everyday life. That's where man sees God. You understand very well, if we were to see God through miracles, then we would be very unfortunate. All the generations that didn't have those miracles would really be missing out. And the only generations that would have a relationship with God would be the generations that were in the time of the Bible. This would be grossly unfair. This would mean that we wouldn't be able to have a relationship with God as good as they did. And that's not true. As a matter of fact, even after the miracles, you see, miracles don't really have a very lasting effect. Because 3 days after the miracles, the Jews were rebellious again. And that's when Moses instituted the study of Torah. Because he saw that after 3 days after miraculous events, they were back to their own weaknesses. and they hadn't changed. That's why he instituted the reading of the Torah, which we do. We do not let 3 days go by without reading the Torah publicly, because knowledge is the only answer and the only way that man changes and improves himself, and not miracles. Miracles are short-lived. The effects are very short-lived because the person has not changed. Our religion is not a religion of miracles. It's a religion where miracles had to be done in order to establish it. But the purpose was to wean man away from that and to teach man how to relate to God every day through the Torah without, and not in need of any miracles. So, as a matter of fact, that's why it says the sound at Sinai was a great sound that would never happen again. It was a once and for all miraculous event to establish Torah, never to recur, because God does not wish to break his laws.
Okay. Did you hear that, Rabbi?
Yes.
Did you hear that loud sound?
What does that mean?
That means that I pushed the button before Don turned the fader down. And that means we got zapped. You know, I would come back to the thing that I spoke about in this whole scheme of things, that in relation to prayer, knowledge, and even into Charlie's question and Jeff's, and then into Gary's thing, that I'm not disputing what you said about a man, the lack of the idolatrous concept, but what I still contend that God has, and I will use these people here. 15 years ago, we were still praying to God in the name of Jesus. We were committing idolatry, if you really want to be technical. But we were moving toward Torah faith.
Ah, that's a big difference.
Yeah, that's the point I'm making. But see,
Abraham also, it took Abraham 40 years until he removed himself from the idolatrous society that he was raised in. As a matter of fact, Maimonides says he would go to church with his parents,
right,
and he served the same idols as a youngster and as a teenager. And then, but there was one thing, Maimonides says, inside him there was a movement going on,
mm-hmm,
a movement, a quest, and an investigative process which was developing within him, which led him away from idolatry. That's a different kind of a human being. That's mm-hmm, the highest. Now you're talking about the highest level of man, like an Abraham.
Mm-hmm.
That is a different kind of phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're talking about a stagnant individual, a person who simply has accepted what he has been taught.
Okay, let me.
That's a different kind of.
All right, but let me interrupt here on this line. I can give you names and addresses of, I will say, hundreds of people that have not fully embraced a Torah faith, but yet they have left the church.
Well, then they're moving.
They're moving. And then there are people in the church. There are people that are in the church that are searching.
That's correct. Well, that's a different level.
All right. So this is what I'm saying, that this poor man. This is my way I'm approaching this. This poor man,
right,
he is as honest as he can be with the information that he has, but he's seeking. He's not stagnant. He's not just sitting there.
That's different. That's a different kind of person.
Okay, all right.
That's correct. I agree with you.
Okay, all right. I mean, Jimmy Abraham. Carver.
Then you're talking about Abraham, and that, I certainly
right,
agree with that.
All right, just a moment. Jim? Yeah, well, Jimmy said 15 years ago we didn't know we were headed toward the Torah. See, we were still trying to sanitize the New Testament.
Well, you were working.
Yeah, but that's the point he's making, Jim, that we were working, and we come in the back door.
Right.
We come in the New Testament way rather than we started Revelation and went back rather than starting in Genesis coming forward.
But the point is that there was a movement, and you were involved in progress and in searching. And look, that's what does the song
okay
say? Searching for God. God
right
looked down to see if the man searched. You were searching. That's
exactly. Okay.
That makes all the difference.
All right. Well, we're in agreement then.
I think so.
Well, everybody, you're getting nods of affirmation here, so they're fine. So, yeah, we got something right.
Okay, I'm glad we could all agree on this one.
All right. Okay, we've got about 3 minutes left. Unless you want to go into another point, we can.
There is, let's see, questions? Anybody have any?
I think that pretty well got it right now.
Well, let me see. I don't know if there's enough time to really get involved in the point I raised before was atheism as opposed to idolatry and why they're just two sides of one coin.
Mm-hmm. Well, you got about 2 minutes now, so.
2 minutes left.
Yeah.
I would say, well, I don't know if I could, I don't think I could do it justice, so I think we'll have to let it go.
Well, we can just pick it up for the next go-round, if you want.
Okay.
Well, that'll be good. And we appreciate your time. We're glad to have you in New Hampshire now and off the road.
Okay.
All right. And I'll be speaking with you tomorrow. All right, I'll be speaking with you tomorrow, Friday one.
Okay. It's good to be back, and have a good evening, everybody.
All right. Thank you.
Take care.
All right. Good night.